From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Now, more of my conversation with actor Liev Schreiber. When stuff comes across, and I don't mean just for Ray Donovan, I'm just talking across the board, when stuff comes across your desk, you must have a real critical eye.
But the reality is I do the craziest projects. And that's one of the fun things about being an actor is you can jump around all over the place, you know? As I get older now, I feel there's some sense of responsibility to material. I feel a desire to be in something that my kids can watch.
Right.
And I feel that it's important that we put our best foot forward, that we try to give something back to the world that's, you know, rewarded us so richly. And I think that is, you know, what's your best idea? What's your best interpretation? Mm-hmm. What's your best move? And that's the thing that you're always after. And, you know, so yeah, it's sometimes you really do got to think about what you're doing and you really got to be careful about it. But that could come in the form of a hockey movie or it could come in the form of a kid's story but you always want to just give your best. You want to show that it's about respect at some level, you know?
As you've been talking, I find myself closing my eyes because I'm so used to hearing your voice on all the stuff that you have narrated. Tell me about your love for narration. I mean, you're really good. I'm not, you know, blowing smoke. You're really good at it.
About 18 years ago, a guy named Ross Greenberg, who
a legend.
Ross.
A legend, yeah.
Ross, at that time, was doing documentaries for HBO Sports, and he came to the theater. I think he saw me in something like Henry V or something, and he got it into his mind. No, he heard David Esparza's program, The History of Rock and Roll. Mm-hmm. He was the first guy who gave me a shot, and he heard that, and he came to see me to play, and he thought that I had a great voice, and he got me involved with some of the most talented writers and documentary filmmakers. I have been so incredibly fortunate to be a part of that HBO Sports doc team. And the fact that I get credited with Aaron Cohn's words is really wonderful. But because it's my voice, everybody thinks I just think of those things. Yeah. No, that's Aaron Cohn. And he's got a whole bunch of Emmys and he deserves every one of them.
Yeah. What is the joy for you in that?
I love sport.
Yeah.
And I love the drama.
You still box?
Not much, no.
Yeah, okay.
But I go to the gym. Okay. I try not to spar anymore because it's getting a little rough.
Yeah.
But yes, I do.
Yeah.
And I loved reading your piece about Muhammad Ali because...
Thank you.
That's been a really moving experience for me, and he was a true hero of mine, and I think that story is part of why I love his story, is part of why I love telling the story of sports, because you see how emotional they are, how powerful they are.
Mm-hmm. And yet, to your point about Ali, now I don't say this to denigrate any modern day athlete, but he was just such a rare, I mean, the courage is just, I haven't seen anything like it in my life.
He's a hero, and in a way that is true. And I'm not saying that this was a perfect man in any respect, but he accomplished things with his life and had a kind of intention, both as a fighter and as a human being, that I don't think I've ever seen before. Or, you know, I've read about people like that in classical literature. I don't know that any of them ever lived in my lifetime, and he was the last one that I know of. An incredibly special man, and we've made a film called The Bleeder, which is the story of Chuck Wepner, who had the great good fortune to spend 15 rounds in the ring with Muhammad Ali, and his life was touched by Ali in a wonderful way, and it's a really terrific story. But just knowing Chuck and talking to Chuck about Ali, just that experience of getting beat up by him was a life-changing experience in more ways than one. Yeah. Not just because he became famous and, you know, inspired the movie Rocky, but because he'll never forget those 15 rounds he fought with the greatest who ever lived.
Yeah.
And what a terrific idea of someone who was... He really enjoyed the whooping he took.
Yeah.
And it's a kind of a wonderful story.
Yeah. Well, if you're going to get beat by somebody.
He talks about it. He was like, every shot made him smile. And that's why he was so hard to knock out, because he was having such a good time.
But seriously, look at how George Foreman has flipped.
100%.
Look at how he flipped that, man.
Great story.
Ali wore him out. Well, he wore himself out first, and then Ali wore him out. But he's made the joke 1,000 times. I was the dope in the rope-a-dope. I mean, he's completely turned that around.
The saddest story for me really is Joe. Joe Frazier.
That
Joe went to his grave with that animosity and that sense of anger, and that they never worked that out. Because that doc, I thought, that the HBO Sports was particularly moving to me, because that was such a complicated story. And Ali's technique for how he would unravel opponents before the fight even got started could be ruthless.
Oh, yeah.
But he had to do what he had to do. He had to win by any means necessary. Mm-hmm. And he took guys apart in ways that maybe he shouldn't have. Mm-hmm. But when it's two guys in a ring like that for the heavyweight championship of the world, and you have a guy like Ali who's so set, dead set on doing what it takes to win, things happen. And I just wish those two guys could have had a friendship that was as significant as the relationship they had and the example they set as great fighters.
The great jurist Earl Warren, I believe, once said that when he woke up in the morning, he would read the sports pages first, because it reminded him, it underscored for him man's accomplishment, man's potential. And that's why I love sport. Because on any given day, when you watch a great event, whatever it might be, it reminds you or says to you that at your best, you can do what they do in the lane that you run in, if you train and if you work hard and if you focus. And so sport gets inside of me because it reminds me on any given day of what I'm capable of. That's what Warren said years ago. I raise that because nowadays, sports pages ain't the thing you want to read first sometimes. Because they have so much power and so much influence, and yet, because of that, when they get in trouble, when they go astray, kids are. I worry about the impact on kids.
Yeah, well, you know, it's such big business now, particularly the NFL and the NBA, and they have such a huge influence on children. I don't pretend to know how to manage that problem. I think you teach your children what celebrity is, hopefully, and they understand and have a grip on it on their own. But there's something about sports for me, in particular boxing and running. Mm-hmm. I don't know why it's running. I was never any good at running in my life. But they're the two sports that every time I watch them, I end up crying. There's just something about them just makes me emotional. When I see an athlete pull out the last 2 meters of a 100-meter dash, or something, and pull ahead, for some reason that just creates this ambiguous bubble in me that I just get emotional and I start to cry. I have it with fighters too. And I see a guy push
when
past.
Win, when they win or get knocked down.
Even if they lose, I see a guy push past his exhaustion, push past what is humanly possible to give of himself in a ninth round when he should have been down in the seventh. And that's part of why I love Chuck's story.
Sure.
Just continue to push past his own boundaries, to break through the pain and whatever is attaching him to the ground, and hits that other level. It just makes me emotional. And so,
is there a personal takeaway?
I feel like it expresses in their victory, in their defeat, in the drama of their sport, they express our potential. But I think they also express, like that thing in Shakespeare, that they express the unexpressible. It must take some profound emotion to reach down into to get that to that place. And when they accomplish that, they're expressing it. I think that's maybe sometimes what good actors do. It's always what great writers do, and it's certainly what great athletes do.
Since you went there, what do you hope that you're expressing, delivering, espousing through your craft as a thespian?
I hope it's just a version of the truth that people can relate to so that they, like me, feel that connection that they want to feel towards each other, that we're not all so alone, that we're not all in isolation, that we share things that are important to remember. And I think when you tap into something that resonates with people, and the physics of that are interesting to me, that we're vibrating together when we hit a certain note, mm-hmm. it's powerful and it's valuable. And so it doesn't matter to me so much what the subject is, as long as the resonance works. And the resonance usually comes when it's true.
Speaking of truth, did I just read somewhere that you're going back to the stage?
I'm going to do a play, yeah.
It's
kind of crazy.
I thought I just read it.
To come off 6 months of Ray Donovan and go into a play, but yeah. I love being in rehearsal. I got this opportunity to work with this actress, Janet McTeer, who I just think is amazing. And we're going to do a Christopher Hampton play called Les Liaisons Dangereuses, which always makes me uncomfortable saying the name. But
I'm glad you said it instead of me.
It's a wonderful play, yeah. And it's a story about the French aristocracy and these sort of sexual cannibals. There was a film with John Malkovich and Glenn Close, Michelle Pfeiffer, called Dangerous Liaisons, which was based on that play.
So butterflies are just extreme excitement.
I just can't wait to be with an audience again. Yeah, yeah, that yeah. feeling is that's like champagne of acting. Is to share a dark room with an audience and feel that connection. It's direct and it's immediate, and you feel strange and wonderful things that you can't experience anywhere else.
Yeah. Well, some of us feel strange and wonderful things when we watch Ray Donovan, which we'll be doing again when it comes back for the new season on Showtime. Yeah, good to have you on, man. You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel N.C. Abwadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Comedian and author D.L. Hughley discusses the latest news from the presidential race and talks about his latest book, Black Man, White House, and Oral History of the Obama Years.
Barack Obama, whether you liked him or not, you want your children to aspire to be what he was, to do something no one had ever done before, despite the odds, who was a decent man and spoke well and interacted with his family well and was a leader and did the best he could. It was a humane person.
Then, award-winning star of TV, stage, and film, Liev Schreiber, reflects on his diverse and sometimes surprising career. He also talks about his latest projects, which include the fourth season of the Showtime hit series, Ray Donovan, today. The Tavis Smiley Show from PRI after the news.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, award-winning actor Lee F. Shriver talks to us about his career in TV, stage, and film, and the upcoming fourth season of his hit TV show, Ray Donovan. But first, D.L. Hughley is one of the original kings of comedy. He has starred in and created several sitcoms, including The Hughleys. In 2012, the comedian who is known for his uncompromising political views won a Peabody Award for his comedy special called The Endangered List. And his new book is called Black Man, White House, An Oral History of the Obama Years. I died laughing reading this. You can catch him this summer on the comedy Get Down Tour featuring Cedric the Entertainer, George Lopez, Eddie Griffin, Charlie Murphy. I assume that's going to be something on television.
Yeah, it's got to be.
That's too much talent in one place to not record
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. It's got to be a TV show, a scripted reality show. So it's going to be a Comedy Central and BET. It'll run on both those multi-platform. So
like I said, he refuses to be pigeonholed.
Absolutely.
Back to the stand-up thing. What is it, after all these years of doing it, that obviously still gives you some sort of, I would assume, sublime joy in doing it?
What?
Because there are a lot of folk who, like Eddie, everybody keeps asking, is Eddie ever going to come back on the stage?
Yeah.
And you know.
It's what I am, ultimately. Yeah. I think fish got to swim and birds got to fly. And I have to talk about the things I see. And I think, ultimately, it's the closest, like, radio is great. And I love radio and I love TV. But the immediacy of an audience, and I love writing books, but the immediacy of an audience, there's nothing that can duplicate that.
Mm-hmm. It's my first time seeing you in a while. I think I talked to you on the phone, but not seeing you. Can I just tell you what a kick I got out of those McDonald's commercials?
Yeah.
Your radio host comment made me think of that.
Oh, my God.
Yeah,
McDonald's, yeah.
Those commercials were hilarious.
Oh, yeah, it was. You got to keep the lights on.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
I'm loving it.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of funny, this book, I picked this thing up, man, and I made a mistake because I had some place to be in a couple hours.
Uh-huh.
I could not put this thing down.
Yeah.
It's satire, and it's funny as all get out. Where did the idea
come from? Well, President Obama was elected, and I remember when you first saw his speech and you first saw him come onto the national scene, I think that people were just, they thought he was, like, to me, a kind of fresher, a politician. We hadn't seen that kind of politician.
Joe Biden
before.
Called him fresh,
yeah,
remember?
Right, yeah,
fresh,
yeah,
clean,
right,
articulate.
Right. And you hadn't seen anybody like that. But you never thought he was going to be president. I was like, he can't, not a dude with that name.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when he became president, there was all this mix of pride and fear because you didn't want anything to happen to him.
Right.
And you would go on the social media and you would see people saying some of the most heinous things.
Mm-hmm.
Because as post-racial as we like to believe we are, he, more than any other thing in our... Because America, I think, at best, is aspirational. We want to be different. Like, we'll write the Declaration of Independence but still have slaves.
Mm-hmm.
We'll put Harriet Tubman on the front of a $20 bill and leave Andrew Jackson on the back. So you literally have a slave on the front and a slave on the back. So even when black people own money, we still got a supervisor.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So, but it's this weird... We want to be better because I think... President Obama is what we aspire to be. Donald Trump is what we are. Mm-hmm. And everything always reverts back to what it was. But there was this mix of these horrible things. They would say one thing in public and then another thing on social media. Mm-hmm. Like Chris Rock had this great joke. He said there's a new app that can tell you if your friends are racist. It's called Facebook. And you could actually, you would see politicians saying one thing, right. And then you would see their emails or their inner office correspondence, and it would say another. So the book was just kind of a takeoff. It's the actual events, yeah. And the people who populated them, but we put the words and ideas in it.
Yeah, and it's funny.
Thank you.
You just said two things I want to go back and pick up. One, is Donald Trump really who we are?
Absolutely.
All these years later?
Absolutely. Yeah. Listen, I think everything. Deserts want to go back to being deserts. America ultimately is a country that was founded in the very bigotry he espouses. Mm-hmm. And for people, what the thing that irks me the most is to, when a white man go, he's not racist, how would you know? Mm-hmm. I don't need you to tell me what. I don't think you need. I don't need an interpreter to tell me. Sure. Like this man, early in the 70s, he refused to rent to black people. But he says it was sued by the federal government for refusing to rent to black people. The things he said, the things he's done. If it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, it says sometimes. So mm-hmm. it's not really that big a stretch. And ultimately, people who are responding to him mm-hmm. are responding. What is his qualifications? Mm-hmm. Is it his oratory skills? It is his ability to connect with them. They feel like they have one of their own there. And so ultimately, there have been more presidents that have not liked black people and minorities than have. So I think that's very much who we are.
What do you make of the fact, I wrote a piece about this, but I don't get your take on this. What do you make of the fact then that, I call them BFOTs, mm-hmm. black friends of Trump.
Right.
He knows a lot of black people.
Sure.
He's hung out with black people.
Yeah,
they've
sure.
hung out with him. You
sure.
see him at all the right sporting events.
Absolutely.
He goes to games with them. They
right.
stay in his hotel.
Right.
They've been on his TV show.
Sure.
None of these BFOTs have had anything to say about Donald Trump mm-hmm. publicly, much less.
Right.
calling him a racist,
right.
and that one guy that was on The Apprentice a few years ago
but he
came
said
out.
He's racially
something.
Yeah.
But what do you mean? If he really is all that, how are all these Negroes hanging out with him over the years? Anybody detected that but you and me?
And then there were black slave owners.
Yeah, yeah.
There were black people who owned slaves. I don't know. I would never want to get to speak for somebody. I can't know
sure,
their motivations,
sure, sure, sure.
but I can say this, that any human being that doesn't realize that that man is a racist is complicit in his racism. Like, you know what he is.
Mm-hmm.
And if he's a racist and you support him, you're a co-racist.
Mm.
If me and you are in a car and I do something, ain't no way they're going to believe that you didn't have anything to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
That wouldn't fly. And I think, ultimately, you can do whatever you want to do. Like, when Paul Ryan, he said, well, this is textbook racism. Well, if you know that, then what you're saying is a racist is better than a liberal.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, what's done me more good or more harm, liberalism or racism?
Mm-hmm.
I can't, it's not really that hard. If he were a racist, competent person, I could get it.
Mm-hmm.
if he was racist and happened to be good at other stuff, that's fine.
Yeah.
But
those who support him would say, well, even if he is racist, to your point, he is good at other stuff. He
like
knows
what?
How to run a company.
In the ground. In the ground.
Okay.
My mother hasn't declared bankruptcy as much as Donald Trump. Like, literally.
Yeah, yeah.
Literally.
Yeah.
What he did was took advantage of a system that was designed to keep men who are rich, rich.
Mm-hmm.
What he did was take advantage of people. Trump University and all those kind of things. Like, when this dude went off on the judge, when has a Mexican dude ever been in a position to impact him in any way at all?
Mm-hmm.
Negatively at all. Maybe not cut the grass at his resorts,
mm-hmm.
but he's never been in a position where he had to answer to anybody that didn't look like him. This man is asking the American people for a job. Now, maybe that's not. He's filling out a resume. He is giving us. He wants us to hire him as a nation. And he's acting like he's not. He's not applying for a job.
Mm-hmm.
You want to be the president? There are things you got to go through. This man attacking a man's race or his ethnicity or his religion is. If that's not textbook racism and bigotry, I don't know what it is.
So everybody, certainly in the media. Underestimated him, predicted he'd
sure.
at some point flame out.
Sure.
So the question is, between now and November, will he flame out?
You can see it now.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it was funny at first, and I think even the people who support him can't wrap their... There are people, listen, the brochure of the Republican ideology is spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you read the brochure, like it's like on Priceline, you see this great hotel room mm-hmm. on the brochure. When you get there, you go, hey, man. Well, that's, I think, ultimately, right. And I think he, the things that he has said and done are too much for a lot of people to abide. Mm-hmm. His negatives are almost, what, 75%? They're too much to abide. And the devastation that he is, leveling on a great, on a political party, I think is too much. I think the damage in his wake will be too much. And I think what he's bringing out is the worst in us. Yeah. And I think a president, at the very least, has to be aspirational. If you had a child that looked like him, you'd knock the hell out of him.
Yeah.
That acted like he does. Now, you wouldn't, that's not, what we want, Barack Obama, whether you liked him or not, you want your children to aspire to be what he was, yeah. To do something no one had ever done before, despite the odds, who was a decent man and spoke well and interacted with his family well and was a leader and did the best he could. It was a humane person. Donald Trump, contrast that with Donald Trump. He shouldn't even be anywhere near the office of the presidency of the United States. He is the worst of us.
You gave a nice analogy earlier about Paul Ryan. Not analogy, you made the point that if Paul Ryan, stays where he is, then he's choosing a racist over a liberal. Okay. So what's interesting about that, but interesting, is that the polls, surveys, and studies tell us, sure, that we don't like either one of them.
Right.
We don't like Donald or Hillary.
Right. I think the reasons for Hillary is, yeah, a little bit different.
Yeah, yeah.
I think anybody who's been around that long and fought the fight she fought, like people like, if you like Obamacare, she was the first one to carry the water, mm-hmm, for that. I think ultimately Hillary is a woman, and a woman is held to a different standard than men are. Mm-hmm. The same attributes a man would be lauded for oftentimes. Now, that's not to say a woman wouldn't be, but that's not to say she's not without her flaws. Mm-hmm. But her flaw, a liar? You're a politician. Ain't that what you're supposed to do?
But the polls say we don't, but the polls say we don't trust her, though.
Well, yeah, but I think that they're always, You could take a poll and it'll tell you a vast number of Americans don't trust whether President Obama was born here. Mm-hmm. There's something about somebody who is outside of who we believe should be a leader, mm-hmm, where they're held to a different standard. Of course, what has she done she should go to jail for what? Mm-hmm. Like, what exactly should, mm-hmm, she go to jail for? And so I think that we have a way of describing people who are other, be they a certain minority or be they a certain gender or be they a certain sexual orientation, mm-hmm, that we hold them to a different standard that's not like the kind of picture of what, mm-hmm, we believe a president or a leader should look like.
You used the word aspirational a couple of times, and now you use the word gender. What do you make of the fact that in this country that there are people getting excited about the possibility of us electing a woman president when countries around the globe
have done it forever?
We are so slow on this.
We're slow on everything.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that I've never seen, well, we can debate whether you like her or don't like her or trust her or don't. No one can debate her resume.
Yeah.
She's as qualified a human being as ever run for president. Mm-hmm. And I think we are living in a very fluid time. And I think that a lot of times, the days when you could just appeal to one group of people, I think are pretty much over in this country. Mm-hmm. I think you have to have vast numbers of people from all kinds of different experiences that come together and make cohesive units. And I think the candidate that's the most capable of doing that will win. And I think it heartens me that my children, my daughters, will grow up and see a black president who was qualified and a female, and potentially a female president who was qualified.
Coming up, more of my conversation with comedian and author D.L. Hughley. Stay with us. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. My conversation with comedian and author D.L. Hughley continues.
I'm going to circle back to the text in a bit, but I'm going to act like I'm the view for a moment. So call me Whoopi for a second and throw some hot topics
at
you.
Okay, sure.
Since I got you here, in no particular order, I haven't had a chance to talk to you offline yet, so here we are on the air, about how you view these mass shootings that continue, particularly in light of Orlando.
I think anywhere that makes you have to, listen, it is easier to get an AR-15 than two packs of Sudafed. Mm-hmm. Like if I go to buy two packs of Sudafed, they will make me provide ID and I can only get a certain number. Mm-hmm. And basically what they're saying is because some people have abused this privilege, you may not be getting ready to make drugs with it, but everybody's under the same rules. I can't trust that you can do this. I don't see why we can't do that with rifles. I don't see why we can't. We're making an assumption that the vast number of Americans mm-hmm. are going to use these for illicit purposes. And so you can't have them, and you got to tell me what you're going to do with them. Why isn't the same thing applicable? Why doesn't the same thing apply to people who are buying these weapons? Mm. It's a really simple thing.
Speaking of mass shootings, so a year ago, just over a year ago
right.
now, President Obama on down, everybody was talking about grace and mercy. Everybody was so taken by the spirit and the dignity and the forgiveness that you saw on display
sure.
in Charleston
sure.
when this unrepentant white
sure.
boy, Dylann Roof, goes right. in and kills folk in the church. Obama shows up and sings
right.
Amazing
right.
Grace.
Right.
A year later, the Obama administration is asking for the death penalty.
Right.
What do you make of that dichotomy?
I think you can
you do both?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think you can be both somebody who forgives you and sits you in this chair and let's get you fried. I don't think that they... And black people are very good at forgiveness because we had to do it so many
times. Sure. You don't see any hypocrisy in that?
I don't at all.
Okay.
I don't at all. I think that, you know, I think ultimately you are forgiven, but you still have to, there's a penalty to be exacted for what you, for, there's mm-hmm. justice. And we live in a, literally, people are worried about ISIS. 300 Americans shoot 300 Americans every day. More Americans have been killed by Americans than killed in all the wars we ever fought combined. So ISIS ain't got a damn thing on USIS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm not worried about a Muslim willing to lay down his life for a Quran. I'm worried about a white man who just got laid off.
Yeah.
It is an amazing country. It is an amazing thing. The thing we will tolerate in the name of what is alleged to be freedom.
Yeah.
The Second Amendment did not give you the right to have weapons that are battlefield weapons. It didn't
yeah.
do it.
When somebody sends me an email and says, how could a black man, as enlightened as D.L. Hughley, given the way the death penalty has been applied all these years, how can a black man be in favor of the death penalty?
I'm not in favor of the death penalty as a rule,
okay.
but I want this to get it.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll suspend my morality. And you know what?
Yeah.
They're Christians. Forgive me.
Yeah.
It happened in the church. Forgive me. Dear Lord, I throw myself on your humble mercy while I pull the switch. I think that some people have exhibited such appalling inhumanity.
Yeah.
And even at that, even if you look at the way the boy got a gun, he was on felony indictment for drugs. So he should have never been able to have a gun.
Mm-hmm.
And whoever got him the gun should be prosecuted for the same charges he get. It's simple. You can have all the guns you want.
Yeah.
But if you have them and they're not legally transferred or sold or reported stolen, and that gun is used in the crime, you get a piece of that charge.
Yeah.
Just like if you're a bartender and you
mm-hmm.
serve somebody, it's too many things that you could do to make things better and to make people be more responsible that we don't. This man needs to get through death penalty so you can understand that. So things that are so patently heinous that you have to die for them.
So Donald is a presumptive Republican nominee,
sure.
Hillary, presumptive Democratic
sure.
nominee. What do you make of the effort that Bernie Sanders put forth?
I think it was a yeoman's effort,
yeah.
but ultimately I was a bit appalled by some of the things I saw.
Mm-hmm.
But you're trying to change a political system that you were an independent, then you became a Democrat to run for the nomination, and then you complain that the system is rigged so that a Democrat could win. That's what happens.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted to be a part of the system and you wanted to involve yourself in it, get in a committee, change the rules, be a Democrat for a long time, and then you can change some of these things. But you can't come to a fight late and then, you know, because you're doing well. Listen, if all those people had showed up at the polls, then we wouldn't have this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
You can't, you're drawing huge crowds and all these people are supporting you and telling you how great you are. Win.
Mm-hmm.
Win. Look, the Golden State Warriors posted a great record.
Mm-hmm.
Guess what? They didn't win. So in history, favors winners. Mm-hmm. In 10 years, you won't be able to know who LeBron defeated to win his third championship. You'll know he won. Mm-hmm. If Hillary wins, you won't know who she had a rough primary with. You're going to be a T-shirt of the year in 2 years, and that's just the way it is. It is.
Let me circle back to Obama, back to the book. You made a comment earlier that, and I couldn't concur or agree more, in that black people were very protective of him. I'm paraphrasing now because we didn't want anything to happen to
him.
And
I think you, in all fairness, I think that you suffered because of that. I think you said some absolute truths, but they were the kinds of things you say in the privacy of your own home because you don't want anybody mm-hmm. to ruin his chances. I think that he has done as remarkable a job as any human being could have done. And I think criticisms leveled at him have made him better, mm-hmm. have made him better. If a coach is not hard on you, you don't become a better player. If a teacher does not push you, you don't become a better pupil. Mm-hmm. If people do not push you or criticize you, you don't become a better leader. Yeah. So all the successes that he's enjoying right now, that I think is directly attributable to cats and to men and women who pushed him in directions that made him uncomfortable.
I wonder if, I thank you for that, first of all, but I wonder if years down the road you think that as much as we love him and love the symbolism of his presidency, that we might have second thoughts, might regret the fact that we were, for whatever reasons you've laid out, too deferential to him so that everybody else got something and we didn't.
Yeah. I think that that's going to be, even we allude to that in the book.
Yeah.
But I think that it's like Moses didn't get to go to the promised land. Mm-hmm. He led his people there. But now what has happened is your children and grandchildren will see a world. They're a generation of boys and girls who grew up and saw a black president and it was no different to them. Mm-hmm. So even if the thing that he did for us, like we didn't get the benefit, but our mm-hmm. children do, I think it's an amazing thing. And I think it was worth the fight. Yeah. Because ultimately, I think the things that you say that you do are for the people that come after you. And if that's the case, I think it was worth the sacrifice. Yeah.
What I love about your comedy, and I've said this 1,000 times in your presence and outside of your presence more frequently, is that I think that all good comedy, all great comedy, put it that way, is based in truth. Mm-hmm. And you just get a way of getting us to see it that also makes us laugh. When I got a chance to get into this, I'm laughing at every page, you know. But I'm wondering to myself, I wonder how much of this stuff really did, in fact, happen. I
mean, you can believe that Dick Cheney said a lot of that.
That's what I'm asking. How much of this stuff you think really happened?
I believe all of it did. Yeah, now, I can't swear to it. I mean, we take, you know, obviously I take
creative license.
Creative license. But it's not hard to believe that they had the conversations that they did.
Yeah.
And I think it's not hard to believe. A lot of those people are so duplicitous and so, you know, dishonest anyway that mm-hmm. I probably was more accurate than their memoirs.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
But I just think the book came so easy to me because it was clear to believe what these people were saying. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we did it for comedic effect. But the things that were the funniest to me were the things I thought were the most true.
Mm-hmm. I was laughing with somebody, one of my producers, actually, before we came out today, because you are so honest and so frank. How do you know where that line is? There is no line. Here's right. I mean, I hear your point. There's no line. Here's what I'm going to get out, though. Joan Rivers always used this line when she tried to joke too soon.
Right.
Too soon. Right. Is there a line on a joke that's too soon?
No. I think, listen, all I can ever do is look at the irony of a situation.
Right.
Like now we live in a country where a man could say, now I'm a woman. Mm-hmm. Now I'm a woman. And we will call you by your name as a woman. But that doesn't mean that a doctor ain't gonna call you and tell you need a prostate examination. You can wear a sundress when you go.
Yeah.
You're still getting the same thing I'm getting. So happy anniversary, I guess. I don't know. Listen, I don't know. Now you can. Now literally, you can say you're a thing and you're that.
Yeah.
You like if and you have to like for now. I'm a white man trapped in this black man's body.
Yeah.
My name is Chad.
Yeah.
Now, that ain't gonna work good for the police. Wait, I'm a white man. Well, both of y'all get out. But the first. Yeah. Do him. I don't have these pretenses. I think I've seen horrible tragedies. Like this whole gorilla thing. Mm-hmm. Like, how does a baby get out? When we grew up, you couldn't even touch nothing at the grocery store. You know? And then the gorilla gets, you know, there were 788 silverback gorillas in the world. Mm-hmm. That wasn't our gorilla. It was the world's, right? Mm-hmm. Do you know what a male silverback gorilla only job is? His only job is to protect and provide. That's all he does.
Yeah.
When that baby fell in there, the females ran to the hills, and they're like, Harambe, you got this, right?
Yeah.
And they shouldn't have shot that gorilla. They should have took him to Chicago and had him have parenting classes. Yeah. That they could have done. It is ridiculous, the things that you see. Like when I watch what happened, the tragedy with the alligator, mm-hmm. when the sign says don't swim, yeah. don't swim.
Yeah.
I was waiting my toe. Alligators don't read signs.
Yeah.
Your parent is supposed to be the biggest advocate for his child, mm-hmm. the biggest protector of his child. We were having an argument on the radio show, and they were saying, the sign didn't say alligators. You know what? A sign couldn't cover all the potential eventualities. Mm-hmm. But I know what? When black people see a sign that say don't swim, you best believe we ain't swimming. That's why they got a pool, right? You better dip your toe in that bathtub and shut up. We're at Disney World.
The new book from DL, it's called Black Man, White House. An oral history of the Obama years. I'm sweating like a runaway slave. So I'm out of time. D, I love you, man.
I love you back.
Come back anytime.
For sure.
Coming up, actor Lee F. Shriver talks about the return of his hit TV show, Ray Donovan. We're back in a moment. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Lee F. Shriver has received accolades for his broad range of work on film, TV, and on the stage. In 2005, he won a Tony Award for his role in the Broadway revival of the play Glengarry Glen Ross. He has starred in a variety of independent and mainstream movies, including X-Men, Origins, Wolverine, the Scream horror franchise, and the 2016 winner of the Best Picture Oscar, Spotlight. He's also the star of the Showtime hit series, Ray Donovan. It's about a professional fixer for the rich and famous who can make anyone's problems disappear apart from his own. The show's fourth season premieres on June 26th. Lee F. Shriver joins us now. Before our conversation begins, first a clip from Ray Donovan.
My story's no different than any of yours. It's been hard for me to get close to people. Let him in. I tried, you know, got married and had kids. I mean, I love my family, you know, just, I guess if you love people, you're supposed to let them in.
So I can predict your answer to this question, which is probably that I should just tune in. But the way this thing ended last season with that confession. So for those who haven't been following Ray Donovan, first of all, shame on you. It's a great show. But you end with the last season with this confession to murdering the priest who had abused you as a child.
Right.
And so where are we going in this new season?
I think Ray is, he's suffered enough, and I think he's looking for a construct or at least, I want to say a faith, but I think he struggles with that word because of the duality. The role it's played in his life has been so complicated, but I think part of what's wonderful about the show is that we try to encompass faith and we try to not disregard that at the same time that we try to understand the cost and the effect of what some of that abuse, the result of some of that abuse on a character's life and character.
Yeah. Well, how have you, I'm going to ask you a personal question now. How have you processed this story of the abuse? Now, think about Spotlight and the wonderful Academy Award for that beautiful film and the role you played in that. I think about the storyline in Ray Donovan. So clearly you have, you spend some time, I suspect, thinking about the duality of faith, to use your phrase.
Well, you know, the guy who kind of broke the story in Spotlight was a priest, the guy who had sort of done all the research. One of the things he said when one of the Spotlight reporters asked him how he could still remain a Catholic is he said that my faith is in the eternal, and the church is an organization. And that had some meaning to me, and I spoke to our showrunner, David Hollander, about that, and I said, this is important that we remember how essential faith is to so many people. And I think that doesn't mean that we can't question it and we can't question the organizations that represent it. As I think about it right now, how timely that is for us, we have to remember to respect the faith of people and maybe not the organizations or the groups that manifest around it. For me, though, Ray was initially a character, it was about understanding violence and repressed anger and rage and something also about what it meant to be a man and to be a father and how to deal with those things. And I guess it's hard sometimes because when you do a television show that both exploits sex and violence but at the same time tries to understand it, it can get complicated. But the premise for me has always been that it's vulnerable people who do violent things. And the more vulnerable they feel, often the more violent they are. But I think that's, you know, that's an idea that comes from history, from classical theater for me.
I want to get to some of that in a second. But before I go there, the comment you've just made now, are there overlays in that philosophy with the Orlando massacre?
I think so. For me, it's the only way I can understand violence like that. Is that aside from the obvious fact that this person was clearly unbalanced, there's some value to trying to understand the vulnerability and the pain that causes violence like that. It's hard because all you want to do is lash out, is fight back and be angry and think of how to protect. And I think that's often where Ray goes immediately. But it's so important that we try to bear in mind what we share right now more than what we don't. And I guess it's sort of unfathomable to identify with somebody who would do something as horrible as that. But I don't know that we'll ever come to understand it until we can wrap our minds around the kind of pain that causes that to happen.
Yeah. I suspect a lot of the credit will go to the writers, but how much fun is it to play a guy who is a complex character, who is textured, who is layered? I mean, there's just, I'm not an actor, but I appreciate watching characters who you get to see peel back the layers.
It's great, and I think there's been a trend towards the anti-hero, certainly in the premium cable world. You know, David Hollander has been so generous with his consciousness and his talent as a writer over the past couple of years. I think he very much identifies with Ray, which works in my favor. I think duality is at the center of all great drama. And that's, I think that's what they've been really good at cooking up on Ray Donovan. A character who at times horrifies us with his behavior and then endears us with his values and his loyalty. It's one of the things that I think we're all trying to work out in ourselves and a character we can identify with.
Yeah, but Ray is a special case, though.
He's a little extreme.
Yeah, I'm like I like Ray, but don't compare me to Ray.
Though. Yes, I know.
He's a little extreme, but I love him.
Yeah.
What you just laid out now, though, is a perfect segue, and I figured we'd get there. But the way you phrased that so beautifully leads me quite naturally, I think, into your love for Shakespeare. There have been a number. I mean, I've had so many actors on this program over the years, but there are a few that come to mind immediately, and they never ever come on this show without us at some point detouring into a conversation about Shakespeare because they love him so. And I get the sense that you have a particular love for this guy too.
You know, that's really how I got started, was doing Shakespeare. And when I got out of school, I was lucky enough to meet George Wolfe, who ran the public theater. And George Wolfe invited me into the public theater as a home and a career and said, hey, do this part, we'll see. We'll go from there. Give me that part. And suddenly I was doing Shakespeare, and I was on a regular basis. I was immersed in writing, camaraderie, a sense of values, and a home, really, that the public theater has always been to me, that I'm very, very grateful for. Yeah. As a writer, what a great place to cut your teeth as an actor, because nowhere is that sense of duality more present than in Shakespeare's writing. And for me, he was really the beginning of that me generation of writers, that idea about I can contain both aspects, the complexity of that you would have a character like Othello or Shylock or Hamlet or Macbeth who would do horrific things and then bring you to tears with the sorrow he felt for the death of his wife. Or Shylock, who would sort of mercilessly pursue people and then mercilessly pursue a pound of their flesh, and then when attacked, remind you of the cruelty that you inflicted on him and of his own affections and feelings and senses and emotions. And I guess that's maybe part of where I went to after Orlando, that kind of thinking, to remember, to never push anyone too far outside of the circle of humanity, because that's when the horrible things happen. To remember our own humanity and remember our connectedness. And that, for me, was really a wonderful thing that Shakespeare gave me.
Yeah. You may have just answered the question I want to ask now, but I'll ask anyway, Aaliyah, which is, what is it about his writings that is so enduring even to this day? I mean, I think the answer you just gave is your personal way into Shakespeare. But for the demos, for society writ large, what's so enduring about his writing?
I think he encompasses our extremes. And that feels very personal, because we all have those feelings deep inside of ourselves that we won't necessarily cop to with each other. He encompasses our extreme heroism while simultaneously encompassing the depth of our weakness and depravity. And to have all of that articulated and to have all of that add up to a holistic, good human being worthy of one of his plays is somehow satisfying, I think, to us as actors, readers, and audience members to know, aside from the beautiful language, what's at the heart of that play is the idea that it's okay. As horrible as we are, or as great as we are, as low, it's all part of the human experience and all interesting and wonderful.
Yeah. You must be tough on scripts.
Well, the thing I like about Ray is I don't say much, you know?
Yeah.
I got like 8 words.
Coming up, my conversation with actor Liev Schreiber continues, so stay with us.